You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. Individualism in an Age of Tribalism by Ankar Gatte.
Keith said at the opening yesterday in his brief comments at the reception that we have a wide range of people here at the conference, some people who are very new to Ayn Rand and to Ayn Rand's ideas, some people who have been reading and studying for quite some time now. And so it's always hard to tailor these talks to make them interesting to everyone. And if I've skewed, I've tried to skew to make it interesting if you're relatively new to Ayn Rand's ideas. And I think one of the things that she offers a lot of guidance on and that one should really think about in terms of individualism is that becoming an individual, if you're really on the quest to truly become an individual, one of the things you have to do, and one of the most difficult things you have to do, is rethink, or in a certain way, think for the first time about your religious and moral views. And that's what I want to talk about in these brief remarks. And religion and morality, I think, especially morality, but often religion, are not thought of as tribal phenomena. So that won't be put into the category that this is tribalist in some kind of way. But I think they should be, or at least typical expressions of them should often be put into this category. And I want to talk a little bit about that as well. Because I don't think it's obvious that they are. But if you put them in that category, it helps to understand, it helps one understand, I think, why they're difficult to rethink and some of the pressure that is put on you to not examine these or not to think about them or rethink them. And this will connect, actually, a few of the things that I'll say. In a way, you can look at it as it's kind of zooming in on a couple of really important issues that Greg Salmieri was talking about in his first session. Yeah, and he was bringing up this, what Ayn Rand calls an argument from intimidation. And that is, I'm going to bring that kind of issue up in a different form, but I think it's very prevalent in discussions about religion and about morality, because both have a lot to do with views about what's right and what is wrong. and the intimidation that Ayn Rand talks about the argument from intimidation, is a kind of moral intimidation. So it's often at play. So let me just touch on just reminding us about tribalism, and in particular, I want to say a few things about individualism. But just, I want to talk, I mean, it's been covered, so I'm just going to echo some things that have been said. But just because, to get again on the page what tribalism is, because I'm going to put common expressions of religion and morality, or you could call it conventional morality, into this category. And one of the things I want to emphasize here is that one of the reasons we're talking about individualism and tribalism is not just to go, like, what is going on in the culture, and there's these huge tribal gangs now, that and we've covered it. Yaron was talking about in economics, Tara Smith was talking about in the law, and there's going to be other discussions. Greg touched on politics, but there's going to be a deeper discussion on politics. So it's, you're seeing it in a lot of areas, I think, in the culture, and many people are talking that what we have is a kind of us versus them environment of tribalism. But one of the reasons to spend a lot of time on it and to think about tribalism as a phenomenon is to spot it in your own thinking and in your own soul. So it's not the case that it's either you just have a person who's fully an individualist or you have a person who's completely a tribalist. But you can have a lot of tribal elements or a few tribal elements in yourself and in your thinking and in your soul. And part of the reason that it's good to have an understanding of the negative is to see it within oneself. And Greg was talking about this a bit in his talk. So if you think about when we're talking about tribalism, as it has been touched on, it's groups that are defined by physical, accidental, unchosen non-intellectual characteristics. I think one of the simplest examples is during the Charlottesville episode a year and a half ago of seeing the white nationalists. I mean, they literally looked like a tribe going around in Charlottesville. And I mean, you think of it as they're defined by white, which is a physical, unchosen, accidental characteristic. And even the nationalism is, well, we happen to be in this country, born here. Tara Smith put it like this, and I think this is a good way to hold the various forms of it. It's my skin color, right or wrong, my country, right or wrong, my ancestors, right or wrong. The tribal elements all have an inherited, so you're supposed to inherit it, phenomenon to it. And I think that's important in understanding it. And I'll touch on that when I turn to religion and morality. And to get that you don't have to be so bad as these people marching around in Charlottesville to have tribal elements in your thinking and in your soul. I'll give you two from my background. I mean, and they both surprised me. But so I'm half German and half Indian. And both cultures, German culture and Indian culture, have real tribal elements in them. And I remember, I haven't gone back very often, or gone to, I was born in Canada, so it's not really going back, gone to these countries often. But I remember the first time I went to Germany, and this was in the 80s, and talking with relatives who seem like good, decent, and they are sort of good, decent, hardworking people. They have a job, they're independent, and they're thoughtful in many ways. And then you get into a discussion about Germany in the 20th century, World War II, and you start getting all kinds of, I mean, it's a little charitable even to put them as excuses for the rise of Hitler and what was so bad in Germany, and it was kind of reasonable that he was elected and so on. And and you get that they're defending the faith now. They're defending a position, and it's now they're defending it right or wrong, that it's the issue of right or wrong has gone out the window of really caring about that. You can have that within you and not be like a full-blown tribalist. On the Indian side, which I find actually more amusing. Defending Hitler is not very amusing. When I went back, it was relatives are still on this issue of arranged marriage, and we're going to find you a nice Indian girl. Why Indian? I'm half German. Why couldn't it be a nice German girl? Why couldn't it just be a nice girl? You talk to them, and they think it's completely normal, and it's like my eyes are. But that's, again, I think of that as that's a tribal element. It's, again, these were productive, hardworking, in many areas of life, thoughtful people. So you can have real elements of it without being looking like the Charlottesville people marching around. And so part of the reason to be concerned with it, as Greg was emphasizing, is not can I spot it in other people, but can I spot it in myself? And the contrast, so it's part of what's relevant, and in both those, or take the Indian example, it's supposed to be a crucial part of your identity. So another aspect of the Indian one, which I found real even more bizarre, was that they still care about what caste you are. And for marriage, it was, I don't know what caste I am, and I don't care. But it's still a major element in parts of Indian culture. And it's these unchosen physical, accidental characteristics are supposed to be crucial to your personal identity. and then you're supposed to have some kind of loyalty to that tribe, as it's defined. And the contrast is individualism. And as Greg was emphasizing, it means it's a real emphasis on thinking, and Tara was emphasizing this as well. And it means that you're really interested in figuring out what is true and good. And I put the example, or as an example of an individual, a scientist there, deliberately. This is a person who's supposed to be really concerned with discovering the facts, of figuring out things in a first-handed, and that's the description you get in The Fountainhead, and we're partly celebrating this year the 75th anniversary of The Fountainhead. And that's a book about independence and individualism, and I'll come back to it a little bit later. So it's a first-handed, active, and questioning mind. And the questioning, as Greg was emphasizing, is really important. And it's then supposed to have some kind of deep implication for how you should think about your personal identity and then the kinds of groups that you view yourself as a part of. And they should be ones where you view yourself as sharing ideas or values with the group. But I want to stop on the issue of personal identity a little bit. So I put up as it's supposed to be about the content of your character, and that's using the Martin Luther King, that he has a dream that his children won't be judged by the color of their skin, so that's a tribal phenomenon, but by the content of their character, which is supposed to be an individualist phenomenon. And if you think, well, what is the content of a person's character? It's two things, I think, is the way to think about it, and I think certainly the way Ayn Rand thinks about it. It's your basic ideas that you've considered and chosen because you think they're true. So you've used your considered judgment of fundamental ideas that you think this is the way the world works, and that I'm going to take these all into account as I journey in my life in the world. So it's your basic ideas and your basic values. So it's your basic, the goals and the activity or virtues you're going to practice in pursuit of these. It's your basic ideas and your basic values. Both they're supposed to be considered, and so they're chosen. They're something you choose to embrace, and Dr. Binswanger will be talking about this perspective on the importance of free will in thinking of yourself as an individual. But there's a deeper perspective still that you can have, I think, on personal identity. And it's a very important perspective to have. It's a perspective that emerges in The Fountainhead. And it's really relevant when if you're going to embark on the task of rethinking some of your deep values and deep ideas, or that you view as, like, these are my deep values and deep ideas. And I think that is often the case when someone is thinking about their religious and moral ideas. They're tied to their personal identity. And so it can be very difficult to challenge that or to think about that, because it's like you're challenging yourself. And the perspective you get in The Fountainhead of thinking of your own personal identity, and this again ties to the issue of free will, is that there's something deeper than the content of your character. And the way it's put in The Fountainhead, it's like, what's the real you? And it's the thing in me that thinks and values and makes decisions. And that's the thing from which content comes. It's the thing that reaches your basic ideas or your basic values. And that's the you, and whether you use it and how well you use it. So that's how you should think of yourself. And that, I think, is a very distinctive and very unusual perspective that you get in The Fountainhead, and a very important perspective. Because I think of so these are my images for religion and morality. I think of these as more sophisticated forms of tribalism, and particularly if I'm going to put it as conventional morality. It's just what you're supposed to accept and view as right and wrong. And what is similar, one of the ways to think about what's similar about them is that it's something you just inherit. Because what seems to be different, the reason I'm putting it as more sophisticated, and Greg touched on this as well in terms of thinking about tribalism, is both religion and morality, they seem all about ideas. I mean, there's I mean, pages and pages and books and books. I mean, if you're in the Catholic tradition, I mean, there's volumes and volumes and scholars and so on that you can read. And the same in morality. It's about, it's supposed to be about your ideas about what is right and wrong. And so it's, so there seems to be, and in a certain way there is, a lot of intellectual content. And that's different than it's just, it's physical and accidental characteristic, your skin color or the nation that you seem to be born in. So from a perspective, they seem very different. But the perspective that they're not really considered judgments. They're not things that you're supposed to think through and then accept, I think is important for thinking about them as tribal phenomena. So I'll give you, and this is sort of, again, from my own life experience, of a couple of examples where I think it really shows that what they are not really ideas. They're not really things that someone has thought about and then is trying to argue with you that you should accept, but they're rather just things that you inherit. So I went, I told you I'm part Indian, part German. I was born in Canada. And then I went to a French school that was sort of Catholic. It wasn't a fully Catholic school, but sort of Catholic. And I remember, I was probably around 10. I remember being there, and the principal and the priest who would come in and give the religion lessons are sort of arguing, am I a Protestant or a Catholic? So they're arguing about me. Am I a Protestant or a Catholic? And this is what doesn't happen. And I remember thinking this at the time, like, why don't you ask me? Doesn't occur to them. Why are those the only two alternatives? I mean, they get that I look a little different. I was the only non-white person in the schools. Like, why are those? And I knew at 10 years old that there's more alternatives than that. Is there any concern with, like, do I think either of these religions are true? So do I have any understanding of what the content of either religion is and that I agree with it? No, the whole perspective, I think, and I'm pretty sure this is what it was. It's, okay, so my mother's German. They're Protestants, usually. They don't know how to categorize my dad, so he doesn't count. And they've sent me to a kind of Catholic school, so I've got to be one of those two, and we're going to have a debate about it. But it's all, I'm just inheriting this from other people, whether it's passed down from my mother or they've decided, no, now I'm not going to be a Protestant, I'm going to be a Catholic. That's how it's viewed. And that it's inherited like this. Okay, it's not a physical characteristic, but it's akin to one that's just passed down. And what your own thinking and judgment and so on is does not matter. And I think there's a similar kind of phenomenon in regard to morality. And I had this experience, for religion, this was in elementary school, but in high school, in regard to morality, that I think most people just swallow the moral views that are in the culture and don't really think about what those views are and whether one should really accept them or not. I had a lot of problems with my school, but this was the basic problem. It seemed really weird to me that you've got a school and an educational system that doesn't value education. So I wanted to learn. I was at the top of my class, but the class wasn't very good. So it, I wasn't learning anything. I would literally take science fiction books into math class and just sit there and reading them and would tell the teacher, well, if you teach something I don't know, then I'll watch. And I'd sit there and read the book. And what struck me is they didn't care. They didn't care that, like, this is a person who wants to learn. This is a school. Shouldn't we be doing something? And you could contrast that to the sports teams. And it's not that I didn't like sports. I was on the second team volleyball. And the first team, this is like where the coach's energy went He's trying to develop the best players. And it was, like, why is this not like this in education? And I would ask some questions about this and get no real answers. So it occurred to me, well, okay, so what we have here is a difference between, I have a very different view of good and evil than they seem to have, and what's valuable and what's not. So what the hell are these? They don't seem to be interested in it, so I'll do a research project on my own in regard to this. And what surprised me, even for the better teachers, was the indifference to these issues. That it was, this is, I'm doing a research project, and then I was supposed to present to the class, and so, and nobody could care at all. Because, well, we know what is right and what is wrong. But what does the knowing mean here? Well, it's been handed down to us, and we have these views. We don't really know where they come from. We don't really have any arguments for them. But that's what we've been handed. And in that sense, this is what we've inherited. And that is a kind of tribal phenomenon. And if you want to become an individualist, then you have to be willing to really dive deep, I think, into these issues and be willing to question and to ask questions and not to settle too early for answers. And it, for various reasons, it can be experienced as even sort of as you can have a reluctance to do it. It's a danger in examining these kinds of things. And I think in thinking of it from the perspective of an individualist, there's inspiration that you can take. So this has happened throughout history, that people in deep ways have challenged sort of the conventional, you can put it wisdom, but it doesn't really count as wisdom because it's not really considered judgments. That if you're thinking about fully becoming an individual, I'll give you three of the things that I like a lot to think about. And one is going to be the Fountainhead. So this is Galileo, Socrates, and the Fountainhead. And what is interesting about them, I think, and what one has to think about in regard to religion and morality, is attacks on religion and attacks on morality, or attacks on your religion and your morality, as I said, they can be experienced as it's really an attack on your own identity. And if you're taking these at all seriously, your own personal identity. And it can seem very destructive. And there are a lot of people, I think, both on the atheist side in regard to religion, and you can put it sort of as moral skeptics, who all they want to do is tear things down. And in terms of thinking about religion and morality, and particularly Rand's perspective on these, it's that there's something better out there. So there's something better than religion, and there's something better than conventional morality. So one of the reasons that I think Galileo is important to think about, so it's not just, I mean, he ran afoul of the church, so you have this, an individual challenging the kind of conventional teachings of religion, and in Socrates, it's both, he's challenging the conventional teachings in morality and religion, I think, in a certain way. But it's that Galileo has a better view. He has something positive to offer. He has a better understanding of the solar system than what exists in the religious tradition. And this is, I think, some of the better of the new atheists talk about this. So someone like a Richard Dawkins talks about the value of science and that there's a real wonder, a sense of wonder, of curiosity, and of reverence for the whole field and what you can discover in the field and how wonderful a field it is. And this is part of, if you're going to rethink some of these ideas, it's you want to do it in the context, and this is very much, I think, Rand's context, that there's something better that you can reach or that you can attain. And on the one hand, you can put it as science in regard to religion, and the other is in regard to morality, I would put it very broadly as its philosophy. And this is that you can come to reasoned, articulated views about morality. That it's not just, it's sort of all the arguments end, well, because I said so, or because someone else said so. That you can have a much deeper perspective on where moral ideas come from, what they are, and that's what you get in the Fountainhead. It's asking you to rethink all kinds of ideas in morality about what it, is it about the group? Is it about the individual? Is it about the individual serving other people? Or is it about the pursuit of his own happiness? What are values? What does it mean to really look? What does it really mean to be on a quest for values? What are all kinds of ways that seem like a quest for values but aren't? So if you've read The Fountainhead, I mean, the figure of Gail Winan is a major example of someone that from the outside looks successful, but from the inside is not actually achieving values, is deeply unhappy in his own life. So there's a deep perspective, and it's that you can reason about this. This is what is, I think, really powerful in The Fountainhead, that you can reason about these things. And the two major, if you've read the novel, there's two major kind of points around which the plot revolves. And there are two big conflicts, and they actually are both trials. So there's a similarity in regard to Galileo and Socrates, who are both the trials. And one is about the Stoddard Temple. And the hero of the book, Howard Roark, is an architect. And he's designed a new temple, but it's different than any religious temple that has ever existed. And this is a major part of the novel. And there's a lengthy description of what it's about, of how to rethink concepts of the sacred, of reverence, of the exalted. So it's these things, and Ayn Rand comments on this in her 25th anniversary introduction to The Fountainhead, about that she is, I mean, part of what the book is about is reconceiving these important notions in religion and putting them on a rational, factual foundation. So this is, again, the sense in which she's trying to present something more, that there's something better to attain. And when you get to the sort of the climax of the novel, there's another, it's a courtroom case or battle around Courtland Holmes. And it's there that you get a whole rethinking about what morality is and what you should be aiming at in life. So it's the only reason, I think, to question your religious and moral views is if you have some real indication that there's something better that you can attain. And I think The Fountainhead is one of the best things that you can get in fictional form to get, yeah, there is something better that I could attain. It's not that I need to knock these down. It's that I need to reach higher. Okay, so let me make one last point, which is there's a counter response, and this connects to the issue of the argument from intimidation. There's a counter response to people who challenge their religious views and their moral views. And it's the weight, you can think of it in one way, it's the weight of authority coming down on you, telling you you're not supposed to do this. And it's, so it's the issue of guilt. That you're supposed to feel guilty for asking the questions, not for getting the wrong answers, for just asking the questions you're supposed to feel guilty for. So in regard to religion, if you're in the Catholic and you're learning about original sin, and it, like, this doesn't make any sense to me, how can it be that without any action or any choice, you're already sinful? So this applies to an infant and so on. It's the very asking of these questions. Like, well, you're not supposed to ask those questions. And it's often, like, this is evidence that everyone has sin in them, because everyone wants to ask these kinds of questions. You're not supposed to be asking these questions. You're supposed to just accept it. Or the whole problem of evil, which is the original sin is a version of. It's like, how can it be that if God's supposed to be all-powerful and all-good, there's evil in the world? And the typical response, when it's stripped of all its kind of trappings, is, Who are you to think you can understand God's plans? So, and there it's a kind of intellectual guilt. Like, who are you to think you can think? And there's a lot of advice, and it's good advice, I'll put up Jefferson's, about that you have to not submit to this kind of thing, that you have to not submit to this kind of guilt. And this is from a famous letter that he wrote to his nephew, Peter Carr, I think in 1787. He said, question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there be one, he must more prove the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear. But I would say it's even harder to challenge morality than it is to challenge religion. So here I put up one slogan, that the good is to live for others. That everybody says, if you read any presidential address where he's trying to exhort the nation to their higher calling, you get this. Almost any teacher, practically every religion. So the good is to live for others. And if you're going to question this, one of the reasons it's so hard to question moral views is because you have to step outside of it and say, I'm questioning this. But then isn't it either that, okay, you're unconcerned with moral issues, so you're amoral, or you're immoral for questioning it, because you're not accepting it, and it's, well, you're either moral or you're immoral, or you're amoral, you don't care about the issue at all. And this and that, it's not always just external people putting guilt on you. This is how it's experienced, I think, often. If you want another one of Ayn Rand's books where this, I think, is one of the central themes of it, In Anthem. It's a short novelet. It has its similar theme to The Fountainhead. But it's about someone questioning his moral views. And he's got no place to stand, because there seems something wrong about these moral views, but he doesn't have another view yet. And it's very difficult to do. And he views himself as, I'm somehow committing a sin in doing this and so on, but I still have to ask the question. And you do. I think that's part of the important point. You still do have to ask the question. And you rarely, outside of Ayn Rand, get advice that you should do this. So I'll give you, this was in the same letter to his nephew from Jefferson. He says, I think it lost time to attend lectures in moral philosophy. We are all endowed with a sense of right and wrong. And endowed with it means we all know what's right and wrong. So why are you going to ask a lot of questions about this? Why are you going to, and he's explicit, don't treat it as a science. This is the typical view that you get all over in the culture. And this is what Ayn Rand is asking you to think, no, there's something really wrong with this perspective. And I think all of her fiction and all of her nonfiction is asking you to really rethink this. It is dangerous to do it. It is discomforting to do it. But it is possible, and it is rewarding in the end to do. OK, let me stop there. And I think there's a few minutes left for questions. Yes.
Hi, Onkat. Hi. So you say that it's a problem when people don't want you to question some of this religious premise or some of this moral premise. What do you think about, that's one part, but what do you think about arriving at answers? Because objectivism is about having a standard and you really arrive at something better that you reach for. Like, there's a lot of philosophers, they just like to frame their questions and don't really welcome arriving at answers. They just like to stay in awe, you know. So what do you think about the problem of arriving at answers? Like, because some of these answers, right, doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel conventional. So I think part of the problem is asking the controversial questions. Part two is like arriving at non-conventional answers. So what do you think about that?
There definitely are two parts to it. And there's a lot that goes into, I think, the asking of the questions. And I think I said something like, and don't be too quick to think you have the answers to them. And I would say, so you brought up other philosophers. So there certainly are skeptics in philosophy, and people who are trying to make it harder for you to understand the issues than who are trying to help understand and are themselves on a quest to understand the issues. But there are a lot of philosophers who are on that quest, and particularly when you think in the history of philosophy. And I would say it's important to consider, don't just consider one answer. I would not just say, well, read Ayn Rand, get the question she's asking, so on, and then try to digest her answers. And part of philosophical issues are very difficult. They're not at all obvious. You should consider other answers to this question before deciding on, yeah, I think this answer or part of this answer is right. And I would, some of the major figures, like Plato and Aristotle in particular, on moral questions, I think there's a lot to learn from both of them. And it's helpful to gain a perspective. And I would say even more generally, this was a point I cut, it's important, particularly for moral issues, but also for religious issues, to expose yourself to other views and to other cultures. It's a common phenomenon in when people start to question their religious views. It's because they've been exposed. They've been in an environment where they've always heard the same thing. And then they've just been exposed to other religious people. You've got a completely different set of beliefs than I do. Yours seem bizarre to me, but it's probably, like a thinking person, it's probably the same experience for you that so Mormonism and the whole thing, it seems bizarre to you. But to the Catholic, well, it's okay, you think there's a God who's three in one at the same time. So to the outsider, that seems bizarre to them. And then it's the question, like, do either of us have any good ideas or any reasons for why we hold the views we hold? And that helps you gain the ability to ask the questions. And it's the same, religion and morality are very intertwined. I think it's important in thinking about morality to have some real knowledge of for the West, Greek-Roman civilization and what it's like, and that it's what it can look like without the influence of Christianity. I mean, one of the best courses I took in college was Greek-Roman civilization, and it just helps you abstract, like, because it's easy to think this, like, that the view, the good is to live for others, which I think really gets cemented into the culture with Christianity, to think that it's always been here, everyone's always accepted it, you couldn't have a civilization without it, and so on, and you can. And it's helpful then to think, okay, so what do I think is good about Greek-Roman? What do I think is not good about it, and so on? So that kind of thing is very important to do, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Hello. My question pertains to the attraction of tribalism for a lot of people, and you might challenge this premise, but my observation is that most people derive a sense of well-being and security when they engage in tribalistic activities, especially related to religion. If you can imagine a scene at an evangelical church with singing and hands raised and stuff, it makes a lot of people feel really good. And Jonathan Haidt describes this as, or he'll say that religion for most people is not about believing, it's about belonging. Can you talk about that phenomenon?
I think that is part of the phenomenon. So part of it is that it's a desire for a community and a social arrangement is part of it. And particularly in the more modern world and in America, that's part of the attraction of it. I think it's a tribal association in the end. And if the alternative were that it's as individualism will often be smeared as it's atomistic individualism, as a bunch of people who never interact, never talk to each other, so you go through your hours and days of your life just all inside your head, and you're a little suspicious of other people, but at most you don't even register and interact with them. That is not right. So there are real needs, I think, for social arrangements, communities, and so on. But the question is, are they based on real connections of ideas and values, of shared ideas and values? or not. So I mean, many people who get interested in Ayn Rand, one of the things that they say is, like, I felt isolated, lonely, because I didn't meet anyone in my school or in my city or whatever who shares these ideas. And there's a desire to want to share them, but it's to share them with other thinking people who hold the same. That can then be warped in a tribal context, that there's some legitimate need there that is not actually being fully met and could not be fully met in the tribal environment that it is, that it's not really about the ideas and the values.
Thanks.
So that's part. What, cut off?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So let's thank Ankar one more time.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.